Welcome back to another episode of Wicked Hot, everyone. This is John.
And Kevin.
And as always, guys, we post every week on the Instagram with a little hint of what we will be doing for this week's topic. Kevin, what do we post? Who got it?
We posted a picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito in the movie Twins. And somebody guessed, but they were half wrong, I guess, half right.
They were half right and half wrong because they did say we were doing twins, but
like the Social Network or something, like movies with twins in them. No, we're not doing those.
They were half right. They did guess that we were doing twins. We're actually doing a little spin on that. We are doing twin films. So basically two movies that came out in about the same exact year about the absolutely same exact topic. Just to remind everyone, Kevin and I will be actually switching it up a little bit today. I will be going over some of the background on twin films, and then both he and I will have two pairs to compare. So get your popcorn, guys, and let's get into it in 3, 2, 1.
Wicked smart, wicked cool, wicked fucking stupid, whatever the fuck, something wicked.
My boy's wicked smart.
Cause the boy is hotter than hot. He's hot.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
So, John, when you say twin film, what actually are you talking about?
Well, so despite what this week's Instagram hint might have been and what a lot of people thought, which is a movie featuring a set of twins, it's basically two films that come out either the same year or within a year or two or whatever, and they're each covering the same exact subject matter. I'm sure people are thinking, how and why would movies of the same exact thing be released in the same year? When you think about it, it's as if a film was made one year and they had a reboot the next year. To put into terms of how ridiculous this may sound. But these things happen more often than you think, and they've spanned filmmaking since the 1930s. The whole reason the twin film phenomena is a thing is for the most part out of circumstance. There has been instances where just tons of script writers are coming up with similar ideas. And in the instance of Capote, the film Capote with Philip Seymour Hoffman, the screenplays themselves were getting confused with one another. There were two films, I don't know if you remember this, but when Capote was out with Philip Seymour Hoffman.
I didn't know there was a second one.
There's another film called Infamous, and it's starring Toby Jones, played Truman Capote. And for people who don't know who Toby Jones is, just kind of like as a mass audience to inform anyone, if he's in Captain America. The first Avenger. I feel like most people have seen Captain America, so I'm reaching out to every...
I've seen it several times, and I don't know who you're talking about. So
he's Red Skull's second in command. He's like the short little guy with glasses.
Oh,
he's
very okay.
Yes. You know? But he looks like he'd be like a mad scientist. He also did the voice of Dobby in Harry Potter.
Okay.
Not that you could be able to put a face to the voice, because it's a bitch voice. Let's be real.
Are you calling Dobby a bitch or just the voice?
No, the voice.
Okay.
And as Capote kind of shows with the whole twin film phenomena, it's heavily prevalent among biopic films. I mean, almost, I honestly want to say like 70% of twin films end up being biopic films.
I think there's like a algorithm out there in the universe where as soon as someone dies, it's like there's this amount of time that's proper to have a biopic. So that's I think that's why you get the Jobs and the Steve Jobs and the right. Capote and the Infamous.
Right. It's funny because I was reading about the Jobs and Steve Jobs. Which is the bad one? Which is the Ashton Kutcher one?
The Ashton Kutcher one is Jobs. Just Jobs.
Okay. So interesting thing about this film is the fact that Steve Jobs had contracted whoever... Well, that's an Aaron Sorkin movie, isn't it?
Yes.
Or written piece.
Yeah.
But I think he Steve Jobs had contracted his like life story essentially to some writers that ended up becoming what Aaron Sorkin wrote. Aaron Sorkin wasn't contracted by him, but I'm saying like Aaron Sorkin, I guess, developed, you know, adapted for, yes, for the screen,
yep,
the story, and the job or Jobs movie with that, Jesus, with Ashton Kutcher was definitely not, it wasn't Apple sanctioned. So that's probably why it failed, if we're being honest.
Yeah. And Ashton Kutcher, come on. Yeah, except true. Butterfly Effect, which is on Netflix right now, and you have to watch it.
God damn it. But yeah, like how you were just saying, deaths. So specific events that everyone in Hollywood gets interested in conspire multiple studios to invest in projects. And like we said with Steve Jobs and Jobs, there is just these things happen because the man Steve Jobs dies. And everyone just kind of starts getting into development for things. And by the time you're in a marketing phase, I think it's too late. I don't know if that's true, though. I mean, as someone that is more familiar with the inner workings of the film industry than I am, I would think that people talk. It's a bit, yeah. You know, LA is a big town, but it's a small town when you're getting movies made.
I mean, if you think about it, there's literally like five studios that run every studio in the entire country. And the industry is very small. So people are constantly moving around and they're saying like, oh, I heard about this Jobs thing over at Sony. And like, here's my first day of work at Paramount. It's like,
right,
that's how all this shit fucking trickles down.
Right. Yeah. And I figured people probably, because, you know, LA is a scumbag place.
Yep.
That if you're in the industry, I'm sure you could probably use that information to your advantage.
Yeah.
Like, say you hear Jobs being made and we're like, well, we're going to make Steve Jobs and it's going to be 1,000 times better.
Yeah. And that basically starts the clock where it's like, we got to get ours out before theirs.
Yeah, basically. But my question is this, would it be bad for business if a studio were to just say, oh, well, I guess they're working on it already. So let's just flush all this money we spent on pre-production down the drain. Do you think a studio would do that?
Well, in doing research for this, I found a producer talking about a specific twin film where they were having competition coming out that year. And he said that they had a story that they wanted to tell and they didn't care who was doing what. They wanted to tell that story. So he had like, it's kind of like they put blinders on it. They're not like even considering what's going on outside of them. I feel like there should be a thing where like if you're first into pre-production or like at a certain point, like it's done. That's a wrap for everyone else.
Right. It's kind of like the concept of planting your flag. Another country just can't come and start settling there.
Yeah.
It's like this is mine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it should be something like that. If you get a biopic, you just or any film, you just say, okay, we're covering this. You can't make any until a certain amount of time, because I feel like that would alleviate this. Because this happens almost every year.
It does.
Which was insane to me. I mean, some are more of a stretch, because I feel like now, even though you can make the argument that Marvel films are essentially the same topic being released, not even, you know, in the same year, like within the same month or the next month.
Yeah.
In any case, there's even been an instance when the same studio has purchased two films on the same subject. Now, I'm sure people are wondering, how is this possible that a studio could release two of the same movie?
Let me guess.
With different actors. Please let me guess. Actors.
Who it is.
Well, okay.
Who is it Paramount?
It is not Paramount.
Okay.
It's actually a French film studio known as Studio Canal. I'm sure you are aware of Studio Canal.
Yes.
So they had been developing a film called The Mercy. It was with Colin Firth. It was about a amateur sailor. His name was Donald Crowhurst. But he couldn't, or Studio Canal could not get a distributor for it. So it just kind of sat. And there was a lot of things about
Weird. How
there was all this buzz because it was Colin Firth and Rachel Weisz. And, you know, that's those two, it's like you would think, oh, this is going to be one of those Oscar I'm an Oscar movie, like waving. So finally, an indie film titled Crowhurst took place during the same exact time, following the exact same subject. It premiered in a film festival. Out of fear, Studio Canal purchased the rights. They became the film's distributor. Ironically, both films were created because of inspiration from a documentary that the filmmakers had seen.
And stolen.
Had stolen. And both were financial flops because it's about an amateur sailor who's sailing around
Nobody
the world.
Nobody wants to even watch a pro sailor sail around the world, let alone an amateur.
It's true.
It's a fucking amateur movie.
But funny enough, the indie film is rated higher on IMDb. Not that that means anything, because IMDb is obviously all opinions, but I just find it funny that the movie that they were so dying to make ends up being like worse than the movie that cost literally a fraction of the price. The indie film was about $1 million. The other one was, I think, around 50.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That hurts.
Now, in some circumstances, twin films appear because of a cash grab for riding the coattails of an already presumed popular subject. Again, this is all presumed. This isn't even something that...
When you say presumed, what do you mean? Like the public presumes it or...
The studios. So, for instance, I will give you an example.
Okay.
What is something... Or I'll pose this question. What actor in your mind is just a box office? He'll get asses in seats. And think of the people's man.
The Rock.
Exactly. So if you have a film with The Rock with IP that has no royalties associated with it, this is really just a win-win situation for everyone. So I'm talking about Hercules and The Legend of Hercules. So The Legend of Hercules was the film starring Kellan Lutz, from Twilight.
Yeah.
And Twilight and Legend of Hercules. For some reason, the studio thought that releasing the film in the graveyard of movies,
January?
Yes. before Dwayne Johnson's Hercules in July.
Oh, of course.
2014, of course. I don't know why they thought that would... Honestly, because at what point is there like heavy promotion for a film? I think it's usually like...
3 months?
The two...
Yeah,
I was going to say in between like the three...
Maybe an Avengers movie, 3 months, but... Yeah, 2 months. 1 month, 2 months is when it starts hitting real hard.
They're releasing this film 7 months before the movie they're supposed to be riding on the profits of. You know what I'm saying? Damn. If you're releasing in January, I think it would have been safe to release it in May, personally.
It would have been maybe not May, maybe April.
Like third week in April?
Yeah.
Not Easter Sunday.
Because then you got the people that are confusing it. They're like, oh, which movie is it? I don't know. Oh, and then they just buy the ticket to the wrong one. Like, that's what you risk when you come out too early.
But at the same time, imagine, first of all, before we even continue this, I just want to preface the fact that both films really didn't hit it out of the park.
I haven't seen either of them.
Well, I'm just saying critically. I have seen zero Hercules films, but...
You haven't seen the Disney Hercules?
Oh, no. No. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah, let's not get that confused.
But say The Rock's Hercules is on Avengers level of revenue.
Right.
Say I'm going to go see The Legend of Hercules. Or say I'm going to go see Hercules, which is the Dwayne Johnson one. But I want to... look at the showtimes. Oh, man, I can't find a showtime. Oh, wait. What's this one? The same time. This one's not sold out. I'm going to go to this one. Boom. I mean, do you think that can happen? A coincidental of, well, I can't see this one because The Rock one's just sold out everywhere. You can't get tickets. And I want to go that night to see Hercules, but I'll just settle for Legend of Hercules and I'll pay to see Kellan Lutz over Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Honestly, I would say that probably happens less than 100 times throughout the entire theatrical run of a movie. Like, we're talking so millions
you're saying
of people.
People don't settle.
I'm saying people, like, as somebody who I feel like most people or a lot of people think like me, I don't ever go to the movies unless it's something I want to see. So, no, I'm not seeing the fucking Kellan Lutz Hercules movie when I want to see The Rock.
But what if you're misinformed and you think it's the same film? What I'm saying is I'm not making the conscious choice to see Kellan Lutz over
You're
the
making
Rock.
The uninformed choice. So, yeah, like 100 people, maybe 1,000. Between 100 and 1,000, I'll just say that.
Maybe that was the studio's move. Honestly, that might have been the only move for the studio.
They wanted to trick 1,000 people into seeing this movie.
Yeah. So they wanted to release it before Dwayne Johnson's film and gain the financials from that. But surprise, it was an utter bomb. Made $61 million off its $70 million budget. Globally, ooh, by the way. It actually was purpose, and this is what we were talking about, how if the studio sees that, we're like, oh, we're going to make it better. This wasn't the case. It was purposely rushed into production to beat out The Rock's Hercules movie.
Wow.
So I guess in closing up on the background, I think in most cases, it's a legitimate coincidence just because of events that happen.
Yeah.
But considering the majority of Hollywood is out of fresh ideas, I don't think it's that much of a surprise that overlap would happen in the same year.
Yeah. Yeah, because a lot of people own the rights to a lot of things, and it's always changing. And with the turnover that you have in Hollywood, people are stealing shit left and right. Like, they have no qualms about breaking an NDA or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
So I want to go into detail on two of the more popular examples out there of twin films. I'm talking about Deep Impact and Armageddon.
All right.
So, John, I want to ask this question, and I think we should do this for all of ours. I want to ask you, which movie do you think was first into conception or pre-production? Deep Impact or Armageddon?
I'm going to go with Deep Impact was first.
Deep Impact was first. Yes, you were right.
Because that's the unobvious choice.
Why? Just because it was better done, like, well, more well done?
Wait, you thought Deep Impact was better than Armageddon?
No, Armageddon's definitely better than Deep Impact.
Oh, okay. Oh, you were scaring me a little
But
bit.
I feel like Deep Impact has, like, a lot more, like, development and stuff that doesn't belong in a fucking asteroid movie.
That's kind of an accurate statement, because Armageddon doesn't take itself seriously.
Yeah, exactly.
Deep Impact makes this like, oh, this is a metaphor for something. Like, this is a deep movie. Imagine what an asteroid would do. It's like, imagine what an asteroid wouldn't do, because guess what? Bruce Willis fucking sacrificed himself to stop that shit. I don't remember what fucking happened in Deep Impact.
Anyways, so the producers of the movie were actually working on Deep Impact in the late 70s. So that movie's been in development for that long.
Wow. Talk about development hell. Holy shit.
Yeah. So basically what they were doing, they were trying to come up with a way to update the 1951 film When Worlds Collide. And they took it to none other than Steven Spielberg, who already owned the rights to the Arthur C. Clarke novel, The Hammer of God, which is basically the same. It's like a twin book.
Of Deep Impact?
Yeah,
Collision. Or Armageddon?
No, Hammer of God and When Worlds Collide were two novels that have basically the same plot.
So twin novels.
Right. So they took it to Steven Spielberg, who owned the rights to Hammer of God. They eventually got Bruce Rubin to write the script and subsequent drafts of the screenplay. It basically went away from the novels that it was based on, and they never used the credit for the author, who was like super pissed about it, because apparently the studio used him in the marketing for the movie, but completely changed his IP and like took him out of all the writing credits.
What?
So,
but it still has to be based on the story.
No, because they changed it enough to where it's like not even the same story.
Damn,
so like legally they got around crediting him for anything.
That sucks.
So Spielberg did intend to direct the project, which they had renamed at that point to Deep Impact. And it was actually going to be the first movie filmed by the newly formed DreamWorks studio.
More on that later.
So some prior conflict prevented Spielberg from directing the movie, which shows in the movie.
Do you think it would have been better with Spielberg, though? Because I think it still would have been the same tone is the problem.
I think this is an example of a twin film, like they should have shelved one of the movies. So right around the time Steven Spielberg backed out of the movie, they started a race to make Deep Impact. And they basically did that because over at Disney, they were starting to develop their asteroid crashing to Earth movie, Armageddon. And I guess around that time, Disney had a really bad reputation for plagiarizing. They, a lot of people say that they stole the idea for Disney Hollywood Studios in Orlando from the Universal director who had switched jobs previously.
What?
Yeah. So this kind of stuff went on throughout the production of Deep Impact and Armageddon. Michael Bay actually snuck into Paramount Pictures with his friend while they were editing Deep Impact, and they stole the dailies so they could like see what the competition was up to and like make their movie like better than theirs.
Get out of here. Is that for real?
Yes. Yes. So the competition continued even after that, where Deep Impact was released first. Disney Studios chairman Joe Roth at the time gave Armageddon an additional $3 million for bigger visual effects and more visual effects sequences.
Nice.
So
wait, Armageddon was owned by Disney?
Yeah, they were the production studio behind it. I don't think it has like the arches and stuff at the beginning, but no, it is a Disney movie.
Touchstone. That's what it is.
Yes. Yeah, I think that was it. So while Deep Impact was more widely praised by critics for its performances, and it actually made a sizable dent at the box office, but Armageddon was a straight-up blockbuster.
Oh, yeah.
So Armageddon had a worldwide total of $600 million, and it was the highest-grossing movie of 1998. And it even continued to be a popular pop culture phenomenon and was immortalized in the Crichton Collection home video. Now it's like history.
It really is a historical movie, which is kind of sad to say that Michael Bay is somewhat involved.
Yeah. They even have,
not somewhat, he is involved.
But. Yeah. They even have the design for the spaceship at Disneyland in Paris.
Oh no shit.
Like the same spaceship, yeah.
That's pretty fucking legit.
It's crazy.
Is that a ride that you can ride?
No,
Armageddon ride.
It's not a specific Armageddon ride. It's just like a copy. It's the same ship, but it's like a different ride.
Oh, okay, so Kevin, I want to talk to you about Westerns, specifically my next two films, Tombstone and Wyatt Earp.
Okay.
My question to you is, which do you think came out first?
I'm going to say Wyatt Earp came out first.
That is incorrect.
Boo.
But could be kind of correct. We'll get into that later.
Oh.
So it's actually funny that this episode, in a way, has become Biopics Part 2, because my first pair of movies is that of the tale of legendary lawman/gunslinger Wyatt Earp. So Earp's story is featured in both Tombstone and Wyatt Earp. Tombstone ended up coming out in 1993, and Wyatt Earp ended up coming out in 1994 in June. 6 months difference. It was 93 December for Tombstone.
Okay.
Now, either film wasn't something that moviegoers hadn't seen before. It was essentially a 90s reboot of a classic 1957 film. Gunfight at the OK Corral had Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas. Like I said, who came first of the twins? Technically, the star of Wyatt Earp, Kevin Costner, came first before the film was even a thought. So Kevin Costner had originally joined the Tombstone Project. He was already considered a huge star due to the likes of The Untouchables and for his performance in similar period in 1990s Dances with Wolves. You know, it was like Civil War era.
Yep.
So Kevin Costner kind of had the 1800s market on lock. He was, if you're going to be in a Western or Civil War or
any period piece back then, it was Kevin Costner.
Yeah, any periods. Yeah, even fucking Untouchables. That's technically a period piece too.
Yep.
So Kevin Costner teamed up with Glory screenwriter Kevin Jarre. If you don't remember Glory, it's the Civil War film that has Denzel Washington, Morgan Freeman, and Matthew Broderick. They teamed up. So it's kind of, you know, you got your 1800s writer, 1800s actor. They thought it would be a good genre film following up Dances with Wolves. But Kevin Costner and Kevin Jarre already had differences on opinion as to how Earp would be structured and ultimately portrayed in film. Jarre had the right idea, though. Because you know me, you got to focus on the most pivotal moment in someone's life. And Kevin Jarre wanted to focus on the most pivotal moment in Wyatt Earp's life, and that's the lead-up fight and aftermath of the OK Corral gunfight. My favorite kind of biopics. You got to go that way.
Yep.
Costner, though, he wanted the whole story. He wanted to know how Wyatt Earp grew up, how he became a lawman, so on and so forth.
So he wanted boring parts of his life.
He wanted, he wanted like the whole story, but yes, with the boring parts and it.
No.
In the interim. So at this point, no one could really agree on the direction of the film. Kevin Costner dropped out. He was replaced by my boy, Kurt Russell.
Hell yeah.
So after Kevin Costner leaves the movie, he basically starts up the project about Wyatt Earp, the one that he wanted. And he didn't care that Kevin Jarre was continuing with his project Tombstone. And a very interesting, I almost thought it wasn't real. 2006 interview, Kurt Russell talks about the production of Tombstone. And he claims that Kevin Costner had the power at the time to shut down distribution for the film because of his star status.
No way.
Yeah, so he basically called every single person up that he could. No one was going to distribute the film. The only one that was willing to distribute Tombstone was Disney's Buena Vista Pictures. So the problem with that was
actually the C team.
Oh, Buena Vista?
Yeah.
The problem with that was that originally Willem Dafoe was going to be Doc Holliday. So he's eventually played by Val Kilmer.
Yep.
Beautifully.
Yes.
Beautifully, I may add.
Awesome mustache, too.
Yeah, awesome mustache, and also how he calls everyone honeysuckle is an interesting tidbit that I always thought was funny. But yeah, because Willem Dafoe was Doc Holliday, Disney would not distribute the film for whatever reason, because Willem Dafoe was attached. There was no explanation as to why. They were just like, we don't want him in the film. Not sure why.
That's weird.
Well, this is according to Kurt Russell. So it
maybe
could be
he pissed
wrong.
Somebody off somewhere and they're like, maybe. Fuck that guy, Willem Dafoe.
So unfortunately for Kevin Costner, though, the casting changes were made. We got Val Kilmer as Doc Holliday. And Tombstone was back on. And it ended up, as I said, being released in December of 1993. It grossed $56 million. Was rated well. All things were looking good. And honestly, these things, they just kept failing for Kevin Costner because his rival movie made money, was rated well. And his Wyatt Earp was released in June of 1994. It was critically panned, bombed at the box office. And funny enough, Roger Ebert compared it to Tombstone. He said it was a less well done Tombstone, which is fucking hilarious because Kevin Costner was supposed to be in Tombstone as Wyatt Earp. And he also won Razzies. Not that, well, when they actually mattered back in the 90s.
Wow. That's insane. That's, he dropped out of a good movie. I personally love Tombstone, and Wyatt Earp is dog shit.
The amount of love I have for Tombstone is unreal.
I haven't seen
Kurt Russell
in a long
just
time.
Kills it. He just kills it.
Everybody in that movie is so good. Val Kilmer is probably one of my favorite characters in that movie.
That's true. Bill Paxton is in it too. It's great. So I'm guessing your pick for what's the better one is definitely Tombstone, right? I mean, I don't think that can even be compared.
Definitely Tombstone. And I will say that I've actually seen Wyatt Earp more than I've seen Tombstone. And I don't remember anything for Wyatt Earp. I remember a lot of shit from Tombstone.
Why have you seen Wyatt Earp more than you have seen Tombstone?
Because I don't know who like what studio owned it, but it was always on TNT. And throughout my childhood, TNT was always on, so Wyatt Earp was always on.
Boom.
So my next one is... This is going to get confusing. It's War of the Worlds and H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds. Two separate movies. So, John, tell me which one was in production first.
I'm going to go with War of the Worlds.
War of the Worlds. You would be incorrect in that.
Okay.
So,
all right.
If you don't know, War of the Worlds is the Steven Spielberg, Tom Cruise, big box office, somewhat smash, I guess?
I think so. Also, I think for the sake of the audience, we should probably say... I don't know, Spielberg Wars or Spielberg Worlds. Better yet, War of the Spielberg versus War of the Worlds.
So the production for this is gonna get long because I'm not gonna keep saying H.G. Wells, The War of the Worlds. I'm just gonna call it the Timothy Hines movie.
Okay.
So the Timothy Hines version of War of the Worlds was being developed back in 2000 with Pendragon Pictures.
Did Pendragon do? Because I've never heard of Pendragon Pictures.
They do a lot of bad movies. I'll just say that. They do a lot of straight to DVD, straight to VHS, TV movies. They do that type of stuff.
Honestly, but they're being consistent. Because when I think of Pendragon Pictures, I would think of of nothing less than a studio that would bring only WWE style films.
Yes, yes, yes. So they actually took the idea of a remake to Paramount, who declined. They didn't want to purchase the movie. They didn't want to do a remake of War of the Worlds. So they decided to go on their own, and pre-production began in early September of 2001 with plans of principal photography starting in October, and then it would release a year later around Halloween of 2002.
Okay.
So Timothy Hines, the director and the writer of the movie, abandoned the whole approach in September 2001 after the whole 9/11 attacks.
Yeah, not a good look.
Yeah, 2 weeks later, he began working on a new script with the producer at Pendragon, Susan Goforth. While they were filming another movie, so they were working on this script, like trying to develop this thing for almost 3 years.
Okay.
So they decided to take a new direction instead of having it set in modern times in Seattle, like War of the Worlds was, and other productions of the movie have been set in Seattle. They decided to take it a different direction and make it a period piece in 1898 set in like a British city.
That's interesting. But I mean, it technically, wouldn't it already be a period piece? Because doesn't it take place in the 50s? Like the original broadcast, right?
It does. Yeah.
So
the book the book takes place in the like around the same time, 1898.
Oh, the book is in 1800s.
Yeah, so they wanted to bring it back to not even before the radio program, back to the book.
Okay.
So they're thinking they're being, you know, they're being on point with the source, and they're like, oh, 1800s, British.
Yeah, you know, I don't, I'm not mad at that, though.
I'm not mad at it either, but maybe a if a different studio had made it, and if War of the Worlds
yeah, maybe,
So, around that same time in 2002, after filming Minority Report, Cruise and Spielberg started working on another movie, and they were pitching around ideas. And they eventually settled on War of the Worlds, doing a remake, a modern-day remake of War of the Worlds.
I'm assuming Spielberg was not privy to Pendragon Pictures.
No, no, actually they weren't. Like, Hines' movie wasn't even on the radar.
Okay.
But it was on Paramount's radar. So they were working, they were actually both working on their War of the Worlds at the same time.
Okay.
So Hines said that in an interview, he said that one of his associates that he was working with on the production would give him and the other producers weird information that he kind of figured out was eventually designed to sabotage their production. And he, apparently this associate worked tirelessly to keep any news of the production out of the media.
Of which production? The Pendragon one?
Yes, the Hines movie.
Interesting.
So it, he kind of put it together that this associate that was working on his movie was also working for Paramount.
I see. So he was a double agent.
Yes. So Hines provided this associate with some misinformation, and he said that the first day of shooting their movie would be St. Patrick's Day 2004, and they waited to see if anything would come out. Well, St. Patrick's Day 2004... Spielberg and Cruise both made an announcement that they were going to start production on their War of the Worlds, and it would release in 2006.
Interesting.
Hines said in this interview the reason that Paramount orchestrated this whole press release was it was supposed to be their first day of shooting, which it actually wasn't.
Right.
That everyone would be too busy on the production and getting everything ready to go that nobody would be able to respond to this, and it would be kind of pushed to the back burner, and the media wouldn't even cover the whole thing.
I mean, this, the, if I may say, though, this Hines guy, he's a fool. I mean, you don't go up against Steven Spielberg.
He is a fool.
Yeah. You just don't. You're not going to win.
Yeah.
You're not going to win, yeah. Especially with Pendragon Pictures backing
you. Yeah. So Hines eventually cut this associate out of the production. He closed, he sent him away or fired him and told him that they were stopping production on the movie and that the studio was going to shut down because of the losses. So the associate left, they made everyone sign NDAs, and they continued on with production of the movie. Somehow, this associate got wind that Hines was shooting a scene with 200 extras, which sounds ginormous. You know, you got 200 people on set, and he assumed that it was for the War of the Worlds movie, which it was. Within 3 days of getting that news that Hines was shooting a scene with 200 extras, Cruise had stopped production on Mission Impossible 3, and Spielberg dropped out of a production that he was signed on to do about the Olympics, and they started to fast-track their War of the Worlds.
Oh, shit.
So Hines' production wrapped before Spielberg's, and they were scheduled to come out about 2 weeks apart.
Oh, my Lord.
And Hines was...
I guarantee you that little thing that I was talking about with Dwayne The Rock Johnson, no one's... That could actually be mistaken, though, because it's the same fucking title.
No, it... No. Spielberg is War of the Worlds. Hines is H.G. Wells, The War of the Worlds. It's a mouthful, I mean, like Roman J. Israel Esquire.
I mean, they're basically the same title, though. It's like one shorter.
Yeah.
If you went to the ticket counter, like, yo, let me get a ticket for War of the Worlds... They're clipping that ticket for whatever comes up first.
Yeah.
And HG is alphabetically higher than war.
That's true.
So I'm just saying. I'm just saying.
That is true. That could happen.
So you're telling me, I think the spoiler for this episode is Kevin's going to tell me that HG Wells's The War of the Worlds made more money than Spielberg's War of the Worlds.
No, unfortunately, no.
Okay.
So, Hines was actually happy to ride the coattails of Paramount's marketing for War of the Worlds. Paramount reached out to... These fucking scumbag Paramount. Paramount reached out to Hines and told him that he needed to stop using War of the Worlds name. That Hines was infringing on Paramount's trademark, which wasn't true.
See what I'm saying? I'm telling you, though, because it's basically the same name.
So, it was kind of true. Paramount owned the trademark for War of the Worlds, but not H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds. So, they lied to this guy.
Wait, so did they add the H.G. Wells, the?
No, it was always during this time. So, Hines actually fired back at Paramount and said that they copied his artwork for his poster, which they eventually changed. So, okay. That's a little fishy.
Well, because the War of the Worlds poster was like the three-fingered hand that was holding
around
the world on fire.
Yes.
Okay.
And Hines' is horrible. It's a horrible poster.
What is it?
It's just an alien-looking thing, like E.T.-looking thing, like zoomed in, like close up. It's horrible.
So it's an alien face?
Yeah.
That's a bad poster.
Hines and the producers planned to release the film on March 30th, which was a couple weeks before War of the Worlds.
Why, though? Why would they keep it so close? Or was it just that
Hines wanted to ride the coattails of Paramount's marketing.
Okay, so he had the idea that people were just going to see the movie because...
Yes.
The titles are basically the same.
Pretty much, yes.
And even the attendants didn't know what fucking movie you were going to go see.
Exactly. So, several weeks before the movie was scheduled to be released, it was delayed with no explanation.
Oh, well.
In North America, it was finally released direct to DVD in June of 2005. Hines, the director of the lesser-known one, eventually came out that the film never saw a theatrical release because the buyers pulled out from being bullied by Paramount.
I believe that, honestly.
Yeah.
Dude, you have Tom Cruise and Steven Spielberg. Like, those guys are powerful.
Yes.
And you know there's some fucking Scientologists that work at Paramount.
Yeah.
Just saying.
And he said that Paramount claimed to own the rights to the story and the name of War of the Worlds, which they didn't. Hines' movie had a budget of $25 million, and Spielberg's had a budget of $132 million. Hines' movie bombed and was critically panned.
Oh, no.
And it has a 42 on Rotten Tomatoes, which is...
That's not...
Not the worst I've ever seen.
It really isn't. It really isn't.
But most of the complaints are that with Hines' movie being a period piece set in the late 1890s, the actors seemed like they were taken out of an amateur British theater. And that the story was awful.
Ooh. I mean, those are kind of like the two top things, I think, when it comes to films, is your actors in the story. So, yeah, that's tough. That's
yeah.
Tough.
Yep.
Well, Kevin, I think it always is going to revolve on the greed and tenacity of some studios. And in this story, it is absolutely no different. For my final two films, I'm covering Ants and A Bug's Life.
A Bug's Life. I think I know the answer to this one.
Yeah, I was going to say, which came out first?
I'm going to say A Bug's Life. I'm pretty sure A Bug's Life came out first.
Wrong.
Damn it.
Yeah. So these are two films people may remember, but I'm pretty sure no one has watched either for about 15 years.
Yep.
It's one of those Pixar movies that everyone knows about, but no one's watched it.
It's one's favorite Pixar movie.
No.
I've never seen anybody like, oh my God, A Bug's Life is so amazing. No.
Yeah, no, never. So the way these two movies came about, all the rivalry that came between the release of both, it's the things of a Hollywood revenge story. Before we get into the films, we need to take a step back and look at how two different studios had two basically identical films. Jump back to 1994, 4 years before both films premiered, Disney's second-in-command, Frank Wells, dies in a helicopter crash. In comes Jeffrey Katzenberg. He is the Disney studio head at the time. He basically was kind of in charge of like the whole Disney animated renaissance. He was behind Lion King, Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin. He was the heir apparent to Frank Wells' position And at this point, after Frank Wells dies, he's lying in wait because of a supposed promise of CEO Michael Eisner. Michael Eisner, basically, according to Jeffrey Katzenberg, promised to make him president of the Walt Disney Company. So Michael Eisner said his supposed promise was taken out of context, and he had never announced a successor. So instead, Michael Eisner ended up absorbing the responsibilities of president and made himself CEO and president, and gave the title to no one else. So a lot of media fallout and other issues I won't get into led to Jeffrey Katzenberg to be fired from Walt Disney Studios.
Damn, he didn't get the promotion and he got fired?
And he got fired. I think he was making a big stink about things, and just like PR-wise, It was kind of a mess. So he actually ended up suing Disney on his exit because of the lack of profit sharing on his ideas. So he was fired right before Lion King had come out, which he was behind the whole development. And Disney basically told him that even though his contract expired in 1996, that because he was fired, he was not authorized to get the money from his stuff. They ended up settling out of court, and he got money from them. It wasn't specified how much.
Damn.
No, he sued them for $270 million and he settled. But I don't think he got $270 million.
Yeah. Probably over 100, I would say.
You think?
California is really weird about those employee rights. As in, like, they do the right thing.
Yeah. So, yeah, immediately following Katzenberg's exit, this caught the attention of, and this is a little callback on your Armageddon and Deep Impact picks, because this caught the attention of Steven Spielberg. And both Steven Spielberg and Jeffrey Katzenberg were the co-creators of what is now DreamWorks in October of 1984. I'm sure people are thinking, how does this all play in with Ants and A Bug's Life? Well, during Katzenberg's time at Disney, he heard of the idea, but no source could pinpoint where. And that's of a film called Army Ants. And it's about a peaceful ant in a militarized colony, which ends up obviously becoming Ants, because that's what the film is about.
Yep.
And honestly, A Bug's Life is pretty much the same thing. During this time, John Lasseter of Pixar, he was working on a project called Bugs. And it was a cross of the story The Ant and the Grasshopper and the film Seven Samurai, which we kind of see with A Bug's Life.
He's like the OG of the directing Pixar movies.
Right. John Lasseter is like basically...
Yeah, like every Pixar movie in the last, like... I don't know, around that time.
I feel like there were a lot of parallels with our films and examples, because John Lasseter also at the time was working with Steve Jobs, who was the other founder of Pixar. And at the time, he wasn't working for Apple. This was when he was, I think, fired, and he was involved with all this. So different reports say it was coincidental that Jeff Katzenberg decided to begin production of Ants. Others say it was to get back at Disney, but it was the company's first animated film, followed by Prince of Egypt and Road to El Dorado and Shrek. So all pretty great films. But in any case, so writer Chris Weitz, who wrote Ants, he claims that he and his team were told to speed up the release of Ants.
That's never a good sign.
Yeah. Jeff Katzenberg was heavily involved, though, along the way. He was behind everything. He got the star power because supposedly he knew that John Lasseter and Pixar didn't really have that. So he was like, I'm going to get Woody Allen, Sylvester Stallone, fucking Christopher Walken, Gene Hackman. I mean, there's like some heavy hitters, voice actors in Ants. So he thought, we have the spy part. We have the star power. I got Spielberg behind me. I got my own name behind me, because, I mean, he's responsible for so many.
Yeah, he's definitely a big name at the time. Big name.
Disney films, yeah. And so basically everything was kind of going their way. He also was able to find out the release of A Bug's Life because it was coinciding with the Prince of Egypt's release. But Jeff Katzenberg, he planned for the film to come out prior to A Bug's Life, or to beat out the competition of Pixar. and he eventually released the film 6 weeks before Pixar. The early release of Ants actually played very well with Katzenberg and DreamWorks because it was the first bug, quote unquote, bug animated film to come out to the market. And it was critically liked, made $170 million worldwide compared to their $105 million budget. So pretty decent gains.
Yep.
Granted, once Bug's Life came out, I mean, it immediately blew it out of the water due to just the Disney marketing machine. It went on to gross $363 million worldwide compared to a $120 million budget. So, I mean, for an extra $15 million, they got a huge return. But, I mean, Jeff Katzenberg was able to cash out in some respect. And, I mean, Disney ultimately dominated their returns with their Bug movies. So it kind of was a win-win. He kind of got his revenge. He got his movie out. It was rated well. It made money. Granted, Bug's Life made a lot more. But both films have kind of faded into obscurity that I think at this point they're basically even.
Yeah. I would say so. And do you think the opposite happens? You know, like, so Ants came out before A Bug's Life. Do you think the like people were going to see Ants and accidentally ended up seeing A Bug's Life?
I don't think so, because I think...
You think the marketing they're just, was, like, so implanted that they were like, Bug's Life, Bug's Life?
Well, I mean, even though the movies are basically the same, I mean, it's a bug animated movie. I mean, just about ants. There's ants involved. The main character in both films is an ant that's like kind of an outcast.
Yeah.
The thing is, Ants is a Woody Allen film. I mean, it is.
Yeah.
It's Woody Allen is the main ant. What are your thoughts though? I mean, I actually really enjoy Ants because I thought it was funny, and in A Bug's Life is cool too, but with Ants, like, I just think it's funny when he, like, because it's such a Woody Allen movie, it's like Woody Allen going off to war. Because you remember how he, like, accidentally becomes a ant soldier, and Sylvester Stallone's, like, his, like, buffed up, like, friend.
Yeah.
And then they go after those, like, terrifying termites that are, like, giant, like, you know, it reminded me of fucking Starship Troopers, if I'm being honest, that entire scene.
Yes. See, here's the thing. I remember more liking A Bug's Life when I was younger, and I liked both movies. I thought they were both good, but I always liked A Bug's Life better. But as an adult, I think Ants is a better movie.
Yeah, you know, I had both on VHS, and I'm pretty sure I watched Ants more than I did A Bug's Life.
A Bug's Life gets old. I can watch Ants over and over again.
Ants is a good one. So yeah, so you're on Ants on this one.
Definitely on Ants, yeah.
All right, awesome, Kevin. Well, before we close things up, I want to pose... this one's kind of a lazy one, but we're doing twin films. So I figured, let's give the people what they want. They wanted some twin talk. So what is your favorite on-screen twins? So George and Fred Weasley.
Okay.
From Harry Potter. I don't know their names, so I'm just going to call them Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito and twins. Or Lindsay Lohan and Lindsay Lohan in The Parent Trap.
I love her horrible British accent. Like, awful British accent in The Parent Trap. But I mean, I think I got to give it up to Schwarzenegger and DeVito. The original
twins.
That's, yes.
That blows me away. I will also agree, because Arnold Schwarzenegger is the hunky foreign Austrian guy who lifts cars up and wears his short shorts.
Yep.
And Danny DeVito is the biggest scumbag human being in that movie. Yeah, what's not to like? They're the complete opposite. Big and small and asshole and nice. Those are definitely the best twins.
So I have a question for you. They're supposedly developing a triplets movie with them and Eddie Murphy. Are you in?
I thought you were going to say them and Kevin Hart, so...
Would you be in with that?
Fuck no, I would not be in with that. Because you know The Rock's just going to be in it. It's going to be one of those Rock movies.
It's going to turn into a Rock movie.
I think the movie is funny, but it is dated. And I don't know if anyone's really screaming for a Twins remake, they're old as fuck. Like, Arnold looks old as shit, and so does Danny DeVito.
Every time I see Danny DeVito and Sonny, he's got the black hair, and I'm like, oh, he still looks pretty young. And then I see a picture of him in real life, and it's, like, completely white hair.
Oh, yeah. That's what I'm saying. I don't know if it'd work.
I don't think it would.
And Eddie Murphy's just been so out of the game, it's hard.
And Eddie Murphy's been in a lot of bad stuff recently. Tower Heist and, like, you know, Haunted House.
Yeah, not good. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for sticking around. As always, you can find us not only on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Spotify, but honestly, any other podcast app that you can possibly have. Get a new phone that's an Android. Boom, we're on it. Got a new phone that's an iPhone. Boom, we're on it. You could also always follow us on social media at Wicked Hot Talk. We're on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, everything. Get into it. We'll catch you guys in 2 weeks for another new episode of Wicked Hot Movie.
Bye, everybody.